Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me, all the way from my old alma mater, Wits University, I have with me Philippa Jahr de Villiers. Welcome,
Hello,
Philippa.
Hello, Magda. Lovely to be with you.
It's lovely to finally connect with you, and I'm going to give you a short introduction of you to the listeners, but I want you to introduce yourself because you are very unique in many ways, although we are all unique in our own way and we don't realize it. You're a poet and a performer, and you teach creative writing at Wits University, which I went to 100 years ago. So glad to be reconnecting with someone that added to who I am today, or enriched who I am today. You introduce yourself to us, the listener.
Well, hello. Today is graduation day at Wits, so getting to my office was a bit of a minefield of joy. You know, people walking with flowers and struggling with their high heels and just having pictures taken. And, you know, it's always just a joyful thing to see graduation take place. And it just also reminds us that we're part of a flow. You know, our time is, we're always graduating. We're always moving through life. And so it's a great privilege to be teaching at Wits University and to be working on creative writing, which is a great, wonderful field. And I'm really happy to talk about that.
Well, I think the one thing that stands out and is always part of Wits is that during the dark years of apartheid, Wits University was one of the beacons of hope, because Wits University was not a state-owned university. It was partially privately funded, which meant we couldn't get overrun by police. So a lot happened on campus. I remember being on campus and the sky-rise buildings around us, you could see the police photographing us. So I'm glad it's still there. And it was a beacon of hope then, because it was, in the apartheid years, there was a lot of upheaval. So it's also the ground for your creative writing. But tell me why you are unique. Tell me your life story, because I think your life story is quite unique.
Well,
especially to South Africa.
Well, I think that all adoptee stories are unique stories, because it's an unusual thing to be given up for adoption, to be relinquished for adoption. And in my case, it was in 1966, which was really the height of apartheid. And my mother was not even, she wasn't a South African, she was Australian, and she was a nurse. And I didn't know this until about 20 years ago. I found out the truth about what had happened, because my parents never told me that I was adopted. And I think now that they did that because they were afraid that I would be taken away. Like Trevor Noah, although he's quite a lot younger than me, I was born a crime. So because my father is African and my mother was white, my mother is white. So she had fallen pregnant in Australia, and then she had come to South Africa. Strangely, I think she was very naive, and she didn't realize that there was a system in South Africa called apartheid. And actually, ironically, Hendrik Verwoerd, who was the architect of apartheid, was the prime minister when she gave me up for adoption. So immediately there were problems, because I did not look like a white person. And so there was a lot of inquiry into who I was and what my identity was at the time. And in the end, they had decided that I could not be given up for adoption in South Africa, because they assumed that my father was Aboriginal, or like an African, an Aboriginal person, because they could tell that I was not white. And so, and by some twist of fate, you know, the heart is a very strange thing. So one of the academics that was appointed to try and classify me racially was Dr. Herta de Villiers. And she had given up, she had lost a baby about a year before. She had had an ectopic pregnancy quite late in the pregnancy. So she had really wanted, and that was her last chance to have a child. And apparently she saw me and, you know, she just created a bond with me. And although she never told me the story like that. She told me that she had adopted me because somebody had to. Because I was about to be sent to the Orlando Children's Home. So in apartheid, during apartheid years, that would have totally changed my life, my experience. I would not have had any access to good education. I would have had no access.
But I think, okay, sorry to interrupt, but I think what the listeners need to understand that it's growing up in apartheid as a biracial child or a biracial person was such a no man's land because you were neither white nor black. So you were a pariah of both major communities. And I mean, I think about it, calling it a community or classes or racial groups. I cringe when I think about it and that we lived through it. So the people of a biracial identity were really pariahs. So it was a difficult identity to have and navigate the apartheid system.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different than being colored, because colored people, some people think that biracial and colored is the same thing, because colored is a different identity. Colored people are people who have backgrounds in Khoisan. They're also the descendants of slaves that were brought from Malaysia. And so they have a very different identity, the colored identity. They have a different language. They have rituals. They have, you know, it's a very different idea. And so I wasn't colored. You know, I didn't fit into any identity at all, in fact. And so, like, I didn't really, my identity was creativity. You know, my main identity was like I was really interested in music. I played musical instruments. I performed, so that I kind of was that person. And my parents,
but I think it almost because of the idiosyncrasies or the specificities of the apartheid system. I think a lot of people that didn't really fit in or didn't really belong found identities, different kinds of identities.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's what we all need to consider, because we don't have one identity. We have a lot of identities. We wear a lot of hats in different contexts. We're different, not different people. We bring out a different part of ourselves.
Exactly. And I think that it's important to be able to do that. But you still have to break everything and start again. So what happened with me is that I really thought that I was white, but I didn't look white. And I kept getting, you know, pushback from the apartheid system. I got kicked off the bus, kicked out of the movies, got ridiculed at school. And it's quite funny because when I was 17, I left home. My parents were quite conservative politically. You know, they were into the National Party. We didn't have any black friends at home. You know, there weren't black people. You know, some liberal people had black, you know, people that were friends. We didn't have anyone like that. In fact, my parents were quite really conservative, in fact. And so I stopped telling them that I was being teased at school or got kicked out, bullied. I never told them. I stopped telling them because they would just tell, they would ask me what I had done to deserve it, you know?
Usually the blame was on you.
Yeah.
But to pick up two similarities we have up to this point, I'm the mother of an my son is adopted. Mm-hmm. Although adopting a child of the same race after the first challenge of actually telling your child they're adopted, it ceases to be an identity. Because now, 25 years later, my son doesn't talk about it. Every now and again, I'll come into contact with people who want advice and I'll refer them to my son. I'll say to my son, can you talk to him? Does it bother you? And he says to me, no, it doesn't bother me. And actually, I don't even think about it. So that's the why. But okay, carry on. Carry on from there. And I'll tell you the rest of the story afterwards. So adoptive is an identity that I don't understand. It sounds strange that you actually didn't realize you weren't white.
No.
Or is it because your parents didn't talk about it?
No, they refused. They just actually gaslit me, you know. So I would say the children at school say I have thick lips. And they'd say, no, of course you don't have thick lips. And then they would say, but they say that I'm colored. And they'd say, of course you're not colored. You don't look colored at all. And so what happened is that I got a sort of like a light. I don't want to like over pathologize it, but I really didn't know what I looked like. I didn't have a sense of reality about like when I looked in the mirror, I didn't see what other people saw. You know, I literally couldn't see what I looked like. I did not have a sense of self, in fact. So I don't want to go in, I'm hesitant to talk about it in psychological terms because this is a time where there's a lot of pathologizing of, you know, human behavior because, you know, because there's body dysmorphia, there's a kind of a dysmorphia. And that's kind of what I had. I really thought that I was very ugly as well and that I was like hideous, you know, like nobody wanted to look at me, like I had to hide. So there were I had a lot of those kind of, but at the same time that there was that, but there was also like I was a young woman that was always getting a lot of attention from men and women actually, you know, so like I was getting double messages. So like I was very confused. That's all I can say, but I was extremely confused. Because I believed that everyone was right. You know, I didn't know. I couldn't know.
Yes. It's when you spoke, when your parents actually told you later, was there any explanation of why they decided not to tell you earlier? Or did you just tell you and move on?
So my father was, I was closer to my adoptive father than I was to my adoptive mother. My adoptive mother was, she was a high-powered career woman, and she spent a lot of time away from home. And so my father was my primary caregiver. And so what had happened is I'd gone off to university. I went to Rhodes University because I just wanted to get as far as I could from home. There was so much conflict at home. Like I was hurting, you know, and I was enraged. Mm. And I just wanted to get away from home. And then when I went to university, I got involved in politics, like all kids leaving home for the first time. Mm. And I got involved in politics and I really thought that I should not, like the Black Students Movement at Rhodes University, they saw me and they said, join us. And I said, but I can't, I'm not Black. And they said, well, you know, we need to tell you something.
Questionable. Reality check time.
And I still didn't know what I was. And I said, no, look at my ID. You know, I put this into my play. I wrote a play called Original Skin, which is about this whole thing. And, you know, so there's a link from online of this scene, actually, when I was showing them my ID book and saying, you see, I'm white. And
to explain to the listeners, in apartheid South Africa, you had race on your ID. You were, yeah. It was as I think about it, you were white or you were black. The race was on your ID.
And if you were,
you couldn't get
away
from it.
And if you were in between, like sometimes you'd go to the movies or something and they'd say, I'm sorry, you're not supposed to be here. And then you could show your ID and say, but look, I have this ID. And then they'd say, well, all right. You know, there was that. Mm. But, you know, you only get your ID when you're 16. So, when I was younger, that's when I got kicked out of movies and things, and I couldn't hold up anything. I didn't have any ID at that stage. But anyhow, I was involved in politics. I was involved in the student newspaper, and we were arrested because we were cleaning. We wanted to clean the graveyard as a kind of a thing in the township, as a means to kind of get closer to the people in the township and what they were experiencing. And so I was arrested and held for just a few hours, nothing serious. But my parents, they contacted my parents and they told them that I was a communist and that, and so my father felt that it was important. And also I was very close. My best friend was Janet Hurd, and she's a journalist. Mm-hmm. And her father was Tony Hurd. And he had just published an interview, or he was going to. It was just before he'd published the interview. But, you know, he was already prominent in South Africans' minds as somebody who was a liberal and who was entertaining conversations with the ANC. And so my father said, you know, you're going to get into trouble and we can't help you. And then he said to me, your mother perjured herself so that you could have a better life and you owe her. And I said,
oh, guilt tripping at its worst.
Yeah. And I said, well, no, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I don't feel like I owe you anything. And in fact, I don't want to speak to you again. That's it. It's over.
Well, I think, can I just interrupt? Because I think this is a conversation I had with my ex-husband after we adopted our son, and he didn't want to tell him he was adopted. And I said to him, you know what, dude, this little human, it's his life. So he has to know the truth about his life and then decide what to do with the truth. It's not your decision or my decision of whether he knows. He needs, it's his life, it's his truth. And I actually, it's one, we got divorced when he was 5, my son. And I left the family home. And about a year later, I told my son. So to me, this thing about withholding the truth from an adopted child is a crime. It's not their truth. It's not their decision to make. I'm sorry I'm being judgmental, but it's something I battled because I was living in Greece. So I had my ex-husband's family with me that in all other ways were bloody awesome and still are, even though we've been divorced for over 25 years. But I was adamant. I said, this story, my son is going to know the story as soon as is healthy for him in terms of me consulting psychologists. I'm not withholding the story. It's his story. It's not my story. So I'm passing on his story for him to manage it in the way he is entitled to manage it.
I agree with you.
And bless my son.
I agree with you. I really think that everyone has a right to know where they come from. I think, and you know, the laws changed in South Africa in 1994 because we got a new human rights kind of law which came about. And so under that, we were allowed as adoptees to search for our parents. And so before that, it was closed adoption. There was no way you could find out anything. So it was only in 1997 that I was able to start looking. Well, I started to develop an appetite to start looking. And then only in 1998 did I find the truth, you know?
Okay. As I said, once you have your own story in your hands, you must choose to do with it what is good for you. Because my son knows the truth. He wanted to know if he could look for his adopt his birth mother. I once called her his mother, and he went ballistic on me, and he said, "You, my mother, she's my ex-mother," but with rage. And I said, "You know what? When you're ready to go and look for her, I'll come with you." And I think that's all he needed to hear from me, that I wasn't threatened. It wasn't a challenge. It was something that was part of the conversation in the household. And since then, he's never asked again. And he's turning 30. So to me, it's what you need. It's your decision. It's not my decision. I, as the adoptive parent, put everything on the table that I know, including my love.
For me.
And then
for me, the turning point was when I wanted to have my own child. And it was because what am I going to pass on to that person? You know, I need to be able to say that we have. So now I know that we have diabetes on both sides, you know.
I think that's the one challenge that we don't have. We don't know anything about his birth mother. And that's a challenge because you don't know genetically what he brings.
You see, the thing is that was what opened it up for me, because like it feels like it's kind of a betrayal, you know, in a way, as a child. I think I also, as much as there was this estrangement between my parents and I loved my father. My father and I were very close, although he had these like bad ideas, like he was a racist, but he also spoke isiZulu. He was one of those South African conundrums which we have, and I really loved him, you know. And so it was like I didn't feel like, anyway, it wasn't possible to go and look to find out anything about my biological origins. But so after 1990, and my father had passed away by then, in 1998, it was possible to actually do this work. And it was also where I was considering having a child, and I was thinking, well, what am I going to do? And so it also seemed like it legitimized the conversation, and it also was a framing device because it is very overwhelming, and there are emotions that you don't know that you have. Like what I didn't know that I had, I didn't know the deep, deep sense of loss. And I didn't know, like I didn't know, although I knew intellectually about the what's it called, the primal scream, you know, I intellectually knew that I did not have my mother's holding me. I didn't have those like 9 months of bonding, you know, like I was in an institution. I don't know who was holding me. I don't know if I cried. I don't know. I've been back to the institution now. So I've seen the conditions, but I also know what it's like because I've had my own child, and I know how that.
But can I? I've spoken in depth to psychologists about this, and you know what? And I'm talking as an adoptive mother. That sense of neglect or abandonment, I, as an adoptive parent, cannot cover.
You
cannot cover, and I actually have to deal with it and not deal with it. It's there. So don't address it, but just give love going forward.
So I think one of my biggest sort of teachers has been Jackie Kay. And Jackie Kay is a transracial adoptee from Scotland. And she's a brilliant writer. And she wrote a book called Red Dust Road, which is when she went to Nigeria to find her biological father. And she says that her mother, and she always knew that she was adopted, and her mother, you know, and also her mother was Scottish, so they didn't look alike at all, but they were very, very close. And she said her mother knew that inside of her child there was a windy place that she could never get to. She could never, ever, she could never, and so she just filled her life with all kinds of other, memories. But like, I had the privilege of meeting Jackie Kay. She came to South Africa, and when I was Commonwealth poet, the lady from the Commonwealth Society said to me, if you had an author in a British author that you would like to meet, who would it be? And I said, Jackie Kay.
And it was Jackie Kay.
And she said, all right, well, let's see what we can do. And the following year, Jackie Kay came to South Africa to launch Red Dust Road in South Africa. And I was her discussant. So I got to talk to her. And she said to me, you know, I try not to let the bitterness overwhelm me.
I love their accent. I find it so.
It was just the way she's got this. And she was the mucker of Scotland. So she's a very, very highly regarded poet. You know, she's a poet laureate. She was the poet laureate of Scotland for two terms. And so I think that I feel very excited about things like that, because so if adoption and transracial adoption is one of my identities, when I see an adoptee going that far, that high in a community, you know, she's really high up. It makes me feel like I could do that too. So in a way, yeah.
And more. Not even more.
Yeah, so I can do that. Like, you know, I could do that. So it sort of works against the kind of natural thing of an adoptee. Like the first experience that you've had is rejection. Even if it wasn't rejection, even if your mother placed you for adoption, it still feels like rejection. And so it's something.
Someone didn't want you. Someone.
Your own mother. If your own mother didn't want you, then who's going to want you? You know, it's like there's this little person inside of you who's always saying that to yourself. And so, like, it's not like you move on from it, but it just becomes one of the different identities, one of the different ones. And you don't, and so until you really learn to create a home for all of those identities, including that rejected child, and not silence that rejected child, but you're allowed to speak, it will sometimes undermine you. It will sometimes trip you up. It will sometimes, because it wants to be heard. It wants to be part of your inner parliament, you know? So for me, it was, and it's so, I'm so surprised because I wasn't expecting to talk about adoption because.
adoption is part of my life. And I think, your uniqueness, I think that I read in when I was reading up on you, it spoke about your uniqueness actually gave you freedom.
Well, it has, especially now. Like this one friend of mine who's just got quite a wicked sense of humor said to me, oh, you were white in the old South Africa and you're black in the new South Africa. You can't lose. This is excellent.
Well, I mean, that's why I said there are a few places that you and I come together, because I'm a child of the diaspora. I was born and brought up in South Africa. Like your father, I came from a relatively politically conservative family, though not conservative in the sense that education was a top priority. Respect for human beings around me, regardless of whether they were black, white, colored, or whatever, was non-negotiable. And then I moved to Greece. So I moved to Greece when I got married, and then I was again a pariah because I was not local. But it didn't bother me, because what it did was gave me the freedom to be who I was. And firstly, who I am is respectful. So within the environment of the family of my ex-husband and beyond, there was respect, but it gave me the freedom to be Magda and not to follow in the, well, a good daughter-in-law does this or a good daughter-in-law. So to me, uniqueness is something you should use to your advantage, provided you're respectful.
Exactly. And you know, the other thing is, I'm a Buddhist now.
And sorry, and to take it further, I then came to Cyprus. And there again, in the beginning, I was again a pariah because my parents left Cyprus. My father went to South Africa in 1939. So, And then I didn't come back. I came to Cyprus in 2000 to live for the first time. So I was not a part of the local conversation, because in here they're so attached to their trauma and their victimhood or whatever. I was kept out because you can't speak. You weren't here. You can't speak. You don't have this. So to me, always being on the outside or always being unique or not fitting within the convention of the stereotype of what people should be or women should be or citizens should be or whatever is very, very liberating.
It is very liberating when you can see it as a gift. When you're trying to fit in, or you're feeling low and lonely, you know, it can be very lonely.
Absolutely, I'm not disputing that, because I to me it is a gift. But on the other hand, there are times when you think, "Damn, I would like to fit in just once, or be run of the mill and be a woman that lunches quite happily, or whatever." I agree with you. It can be a very, very lonely place at times.
But I must say, I mean, you know, last night at our, we did a writing event for the creative writing alumni. So we're trying to set up a fund for students who are struggling to pay fees. And so there were all these writers in the room and all these people that want to be writers, and you know, they're all these lonely misfits, a whole bunch of misfits. And it was like, when you put them all together, they're all so happy to be together. They can't last too long together, just an hour or an hour and a half, and then they need to go their separate ways. But
well, they come in to recharge batteries. Exactly. They come together to recharge batteries. Tell me, when did the fact that you were unique, is that one of the reasons you stepped out into creativity like poetry, or did poetry give you the ability, your creativeness give you the ability to cope? Because poetry and creative writing is your professional identity.
Well, you know, the thing is that I think for me, it's really about, I come from a background of make do with what you have, get the most out of what you have, right? So it wasn't really uniqueness, I think, that from within me, I felt like I needed to be able to relate to other South Africans. I needed to be, so at one point, I really just immersed myself in what it is to be a Black person in South Africa, you know? I just did not want to have anything to do with whiteness, you know, and in doing that, it was constantly reflected back to me that I will never be able to get rid of my whiteness, you know. I can't be Black. I can't be a Black South African. But then I couldn't even fit into whiteness. I just couldn't. I couldn't speak as a white person. So even, and I think I wanted to find out what my story was. So it took me 20 years to find the words to also to find the facts, you know. It took me a long time to find the facts to tell the story. So then just telling that story and actually overcoming the shame, the guilt, and all of that could only happen because of poetry. But poetry happened because of sound. So I had this thing that I had to prove that I was better, that I was an adequate writer or an adequate actor or an adequate anything. And it had to be above and beyond the circumstances of my identity. Like, I couldn't use this unique gift of being this kind of freak. I couldn't use that to advance myself. I had to be technically as good as the next person. So I never allowed that to be the reason why I was moving forward. You know, I wanted to move forward because I was a good poet, because, and I'm really glad that I had that restraint. because
I agree, because it puts you in a healthier place emotionally anyway.
Exactly, because who you are can never be taken away from you. And it's only literally very recently that I'm always doing work on integration. I'm always doing spiritual work on integration. I'm a Buddhist, but all the work that I do on integration, all the work that I do on my identity, on healing, is for my own benefit, but also for the benefit of the collective. And who that collective is how I identify myself now as a Black South African. I identify as a Black South African, and I identify as a Black person, as an African. When I go to Ghana, my father's Ghanaian. When I go to Ghana, my family and my friends in Ghana welcome me as a Ghanaian. So whatever benefit I get out of my life and out of the things that come to me, the gifts that come to me, that benefit accrues to them as well. And I wanted to, that's the way I like working with it.
Well, I find it strange. I mean, I'm listening to you. I find it strange that to me, despite having been brought up in apartheid South Africa, I'm the person within a conversation that also talks about inclusivity, not leaving people out, and being quite strong voiced about it. I mean, people say to me, you talk about women's rights. I said, I'm not talking about women's rights. I'm talking about women's rights in addition to disabled, economic challenge. I'm talking about all the people that are different from alpha, white, heterosexual, educated, healthy males. Okay. So to me, I think, and I have to credit my family, because despite being politically conservative, I mean, my father went to South Africa because he wanted to create a life. He couldn't get in the Cyprus of then, which was war and poverty and whatever. Yet my wings were never clipped. We would have these really strong discussions and disagreements. Mm. But my wings were never clipped. I was always, and I think maybe being the third child also helped, because there's a lot more liberty in being the third child. You've got a lot more freedom. But I really have to credit them for not wanting or not being able to control my innate being of being inclusive and reacting when people are unfair or unjust to others. And I remember as a white South African being told, why are you fighting apartheid? Why are you fighting a system that gives you privilege? And I'd say to him, are you actually listening to what you're saying?
It's crazy.
Are you listening to what you're saying, that I must maintain this? But why do I feel good if other people are not good? It's a collective. It's a chain. We're a chain that we're interconnected. So me being good without you being good, and I mean, that's the essence of Ubuntu, is so fragile, not fragile, it's open to collapse, which means I'm insecure. The only way I can be insecure and we can be insecure is if we are as respectful and as an inclusive as we can.
I agree with you. I so agree with you. And I don't think that it's a mistake that you grew up in South Africa, because South Africa feels like a laboratory for the human race, you know, for us to try out the worst possible things and the best possible things that come out of that. And so, like, at the moment, I'm just really proud to be South African. I'm really proud that we did the ICJ case, and I want us to do another one. I think it's time for another one, because they didn't listen and they're not listening, and we need to keep saying this stuff.
Now, I mean, people keep on saying to me, but is it really a genocide? I said, dude, look at what's happening. They're killing kids. They're killing women. They are killing civilians. And when you start killing young boys, women, and children, you're actually trying to stop the race from procreating. It's genocide. What other word can you get
genocide.
For it? What
it's a genocide. Word? It's a genocide. And they will not. And we have to just keep saying it. We have to keep calling our ancestors, the thousand voices of our ancestors, and say, it's a genocide. It's a genocide. You can beat us. You can shut us up. that you will do that. You will try and do that. But it is clear. Yeah,
it's a genocide.
It's a genocide.
There's not, and that's why I think the special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, for the occupied Palestinian territories, I think she's a goddess.
I can't believe that she didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, why did they give it to? They gave it to the West Bank, like that woman who's taking over the West Bank. What is that?
No, I mean, I thought to myself, you know what? She's the work she's done. Without actually being officially having a salary, she's got to find funding to get a salary and be careful of who's funding her. She's had personal threats to herself and her family, yet her moral integrity is unshakable. I think, I mean, I often put on Twitter that she is a hero and a role model that we should all aspire to be, or all the people around us, the kids around us should aspire. Someone who stands their ground because it's the right thing to do. As simple
it's
as that.
True.
She's got no political gain or money
gain.
It's true. In fact, quite the contrary.
It's true. And you know, in South Africa, like growing up as a white South African during apartheid, for myself, I think to have been able to cultivate this kind of humanism, you know, in a space of comfort, you know, having swimming pool, ballet lessons and everything, but still have this deep commitment to humanism. It's like, it's really you. It's a wonderful, wonderful way to grow up.
But that's why I say I'm very grateful for having grown up in that home, because we had a house, a governess, whatever you want to call her, it didn't even occur to any of us not to say please and thank you. It didn't even occur to us that we would ask her to do things we couldn't do ourselves. Birthdays, Christmas, she was always included in presents. Her kids were included in presents. We had conversations.
Yeah.
So to me, this life lesson of whatever status or level anyone has within your household, the level of respect is non-negotiable, whether I'm speaking to my dad or to Jane. Well, I mean, I had up till the age of about two, I had her sister. And there was an experience when I got stuck in the room. I was about 1.5. I got stuck in the room, and there was in the building, there was a black man that used to clean the floors. It was those wooden floors that they used to wax. And at the door, here's this big black man. And at the door, he had an epileptic fit. And I was stuck in the room, this 1.5-year-old little child, and she was on the other side. And her and my mother, they couldn't get across to pick me up because they couldn't step over him. And I stopped speaking for about 6 months from shock. She used to sit and cuddle me for hours, trying to cajole me into speaking, giving me things and singing songs to me. I mean, it was a mutual respect. So to me, this lived experience of kindness, I mean, I still remember, and I still remember her sister. But she spent hours trying to talk me into, no, making me feel safe to speak again. Because, I mean, the moment I started talking, I never stopped. But that's another story. But she spent hours because this little human of 1.5 saw this big black man going into an epileptic fit in the door.
So.
But I mean, there were a lot of acts of kindness, and it was within the family. It wasn't black or white. She was a member of the family, and the kindness was to me. She watched me like my mother watched me when my mom wasn't there.
So
to me, it was a very big blessing to live in a household that was respectful to
humans.
So
if you think about it, she herself is a composite of the love and the care that comes from her culture and from her mother and her family and those values. So you got that from her, you know. So that came through her. And I think that's the other thing. Like my father's a Buddhist, and he lives in Australia, and my Ghanaian father.
Your birth father.
And so we're very close. We've had a really great 20 or so, 20 odd years getting to know each other. I mean, it can never be that, you know, there's still that gap, but we really get on, and you know, he's very, because he grew up during Kwame Nkrumah's as Kwame Nkrumah was building the first Ghana, you know, so he had this great sense of positivity. He had very positive. He feels very positive about being an African. He never felt like it was any kind of deficit. There was anything embarrassing about being African, and so he is always very happy to hear when white people are able to actually take in the excellence of African, you know, people, you know, what African, because he says, like, we don't have anything material except for our resources, which everyone's trying to take from us. But the people just get the real wealth in people is often overlooked.
I agree with you. The generosity of spirit that they bring with
it's
them,
like,
or not.
It is something that the Dalai Lama noticed that when he came to Africa. Constantly, Buddhist teachers come to Africa and they are just always wowed by the compassion, like the innate compassion. And that, you know, African people are considered to be quite, you know, highly developed in that way, you know. Mm. But the economics is another thing.
This brings me to a story. I was speaking to my sister last night and she was telling me about going to a play place in Johannesburg with her grandkids and
Bambanani.
And a little grand, no, Jolly
Josie. Jolly Josie, okay.
Something like that. I don't know if they, but it's, it ends with Josie because, and she said that her little granddaughter, who's just, she's just turned four, found a little girl that was two that was, got lost somewhere. She was feeling very insecure and took her under her wing. Even though they didn't speak the same language, I think the little girl was German. And after the little girl's mother came and found my sister, she said to her, you know what? You South Africans are so generous. In Germany, no one speaks to you. Here in South Africa, people actually speak to you. They're nice to you. And my sister said she was so proud of her little granddaughter that saw this little girl that was alone. She was half her size. And she just took her by the hand, encouraged her to go forward, and ensured she wasn't alone. So I agree with you, South Africans. Maybe it's our history. Maybe it's our history, or maybe it's the amalgam of cultures within our history.
No, I think also because,
that has brought out the generosity of...
Because African people were not wiped out completely and were very intimate, had very intimate relationships with the people that they worked for, you know? It's not just a relationship of subservience. There are other things. There are other things that happen in that kind of.
Well, there's a in that. I mean, especially in the, within the home, it's a relationship of caring. Because if you don't care for the person who cares for the most important thing in your life, which is your children, you're not going to get the. She's not going to give the care your kids
exactly.
need. So to me, but you also need to understand that. Not everyone understands that. But by giving to your caregiver, and I'm using that word in the, giving your caregiver the respect and the love she deserves means that she's going to give your kids what she can, which is love and respect. I mean, I love the song she used to sing to us. There's nothing like the lullabies, the black lullabies. I even sing them to my son, and he's got no connection to Africa. I mean, I think it's a circular relationship, but I agree with you. They weren't made about it, especially within homes. The relationship was very intimate because that person lived with you, warts and all.
Absolutely.
So how are we going to end this awesome discussion?
I know.
Is identity something you talk about a lot in your work, or is it just a piece of what you talk about in your poetry and your performance?
You know, I'm going to end with my mentor, Kiaripeti Khosetsile, who was he was the poet laureate of South Africa, from 2006 until he passed away in 2018. And, you know, it was during this time, well, it was because of a poem of his that had been translated into a song that had been and was sung by a singer called Vusi Mahlasela that I became a poet at all. Because even though I love poetry and I'd always loved poetry, I never thought that I could do it. I mean, even though school said that, you know, school said I did well in English and things, but I still felt like I felt there was a revolution. We had to focus on liberating the country, and how could I even think of being a poet? And then I heard this song called Red Song by Kiaripeti Khosetsile, sung by Vusi Mahlasela. And something in my heart just, it was like so electric, this feeling. Mm. And I just wanted to know this man. I just wanted to learn from him. And I felt like if I could write poetry like that. And I think that was a kind of an awakening. And so I went about trying to get his attention. It took me about 14 years.
The perseverance is
but
there.
It was in the time, but I thought, how am I going to get his attention? Because I have to become a poet. I have to become a better poet. So I started working as a poet. I wrote poetry. I started writing, but also I just needed to find a way to make a living. I wanted to have a baby. I was building a life. I was busy weaving myself a life, you know, that made sense to me, where I wasn't pretending to be something that I wasn't, you know, that was the main thing. And to have the sense of integrity and yes, no, I'm not pretending. I am actually a Black South African. I identify as a Black South African, but I don't speak isiXhosa or isiZulu fluently, even though, you know, all of these things, all these T's and C's. So I think maybe what I would like to do is to end with a poem.
Please do.
Would you like that? Okay.
I would love that. And then just before you read your poem, I want to say that this conversation also went in an unexpected but very intriguing direction. And I look forward when I come back to South Africa to meeting you. Because when my sister lives in Gauteng, which means we're in the same area. So I look forward to actually having more conversations with you. Hopefully I will come back this year because there are new babies being born and baptisms. So hoping I'll be back and I will reach out because I would love to carry on this conversation in conjunction with also meeting Irene Stefano, the three
of us. Yeah, that would be lovely. I love Irene. And okay. I believe you also met Ari Sitas. I'm surrounded.
Yes, I did meet him. I would like to reconnect with him, but he doesn't answer emails, but that's cool. People, you reconnect with people when they're ready to reconnect with
you. So he was my PhD supervisor. So I feel like I'm surrounded by Cypriot angels.
Well, he comes to Cyprus regularly because he's got a strong connection to the academic world here. And that's where I met him. So, yes, he is. He's awesome. So bloody smart.
He's amazing. So this.
And don't you know Renos Panoudis? Do you know Renos
Panoudis? I don't know him, no. Yes, I do. What am I saying? Of course I know Renos. Yes, I do. Yes, Renos wrote the book about Sefenders. He wrote a play about Sefenders.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's amazing.
That to me, I only interview women. I interviewed Renos because of that, because I needed, as an ex-South African or someone who's lived in South Africa, especially during the years of Sefenders, I needed to interview Renos. And that hearing that story was such an eye-opener for me. Anyway, so we have a lot of common friends. Next time I come, we will reconnect all of us together. I really look forward.
So this poem is...
Lovely to have you. Lovely to have you with us, Philippa. And we're closing to the listeners. We're closing with this beautiful poem that Philippa will read to us.
This is the first poem that I ever wrote about being adopted. And it's sort of... You'll hear what you'll hear what it, yeah, I hope it will reach your heart. One thing. Infants don't remember. I can't recall the rough blanket of the nurse's love bundled out in bulk to the baby's awaiting placement. The metal deafness of her pen charting our progress, our feeding and feces, all of this is gone. Her kind indifference, like the white bars of our cots, confining each of us to our clean, dry, comfortable, solitary cells, may or may not have been there. I might have made it up. She may have cared. I don't remember giving up crying or ever wanting for anything, except that I always did want something, besides the usual milk and material, good stuff, but not enough. I think maybe what I wanted and what I want is to remember, that's all. Remember my story clearly. My mind is a hand reaching out to trace the features of a forgotten face. Waves retreat, expose the beach, naked snails and crabs sucking and pinching. That's from Taller Than Buildings.
Thank you, Philippa, and to the listeners and to you. Listeners, thank you for listening, and to you, big thank you, and see
thank you
soon.
Thank you very much.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open, diverse, free.